I'm Mark Caro, and welcome to episode 185 of Caro Pop. If you'd like to support us, please go to caropop.com. This week's episode is devoted to not an artist who makes, produces, or engineers music, but rather to one of my favorite instruments used in such music, the Rickenbacker guitar. John Hall, our guest, has been CEO of this family-owned business since 1984, right around the time REM was leading a Rickenbacker renaissance. Mike Mills played a Rickenbacker bass, and Peter Buck's chimey guitar sounds inspired a generation of jangly bands. Roger McGuinn of the Byrds famously used a 12-string Rickenbacker on the Byrds' 1965 version of Bob Dylan's Mr. Tambourine Man, which basically invented folk rock and entered the word jangle into the rock lexicon. McGuinn had been inspired by seeing the Beatles play Rickenbackers in A Hard Day's Night, John Lennon on a 6-string 325, and George Harrison with his 12-string 360. Paul McCartney joined the Rick Party in 1965 when he began playing the left-handed Rickenbacker 4001S bass. 15-year-old John Hall was there when this bass was delivered to McCartney at a Hollywood house where the Beatles were staying when they played the Hollywood Bowl. Hall befriended McGuinn there and has a hell of a story about what the Beatles and others were up to in that house. The Beatles propelled the early rock surge of Rickenbacker use. Pete Townsend and John Fogerty played Rick guitars, as did later Mike Campbell of Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, Paul Weller of The Jam, Donnie Marr of The Smiths, and Susanna Hoffs of The Bangles. Rick bassists included John Entwistle, Chris Squire of Yes, Geddy Lee of Rush, and Lemmy of Motorhead. Yet the company dates back to well before the rock era. It was founded in 1931 by Adolph Rickenbacker and George S. Beecham, and made Hawaiian lap steel guitars. Francis C. Hall, John's father, bought the company in 1953 and brought it into the modern era with a focus on electric and acoustic instruments. The guitars were made at one factory in California and still are. Now 75 and living in England, John Hall explains why Rickenbacker has refused to expand its production to overseas facilities, no matter how much the guitar's demand has exceeded their supply. He tells of Rickenbacker's fierce protection of its trademark, preventing other companies from making cheaper knockoffs. He also discusses the differences between hollow-bodied and solid-bodied Ricks, and distinctions between the classic 330 and 360 models. How much of the electric 12-string guitar market does Rickenbacker own? How does Rickenbacker's production of 12-strings and 6-strings compare? Vintage Ricks sell for a lot of money, but are they actually better made than newly manufactured ones? For the record, by the way, it is pronounced Rickenbacker, not Rickenbacker. Please enjoy this Caro Pop conversation with John Hall. Just for the record, it's Rickenbacker, not Rickenbacker, right?
It is definitely Rickenbacker.
Yeah, that's always, people always say, well, Rickenbacker. I'm like, no, I think it's Backer. And so you basically were born into this business, right? I mean, your dad had been running it by the time you were born? I mean,
well, for better or worse, he actually started, he was partners with Leo Fender in 1946. And yes, that was before I was born, but he purchased Rickenbacker in 1953, and there was an overlap of a few years with his interest with Fender and Rickenbacker. Yes, I would have been roughly 3 years old when he bought Rickenbacker.
And are you still the CEO of it?
I am technically still the CEO. To be honest with you, I don't do an awful lot there anymore, at least not in the shop or the headquarters or whatever. The things I do, I attend some events primarily here in Europe. I've done some other promotional kind of things here. I've given a few public meet and greets and things like that. But as far as the day-to-day, no. My son and my son-in-law are running the day-to-day business.
Right. That was what I had read. And but how long did you run the day-to-day business?
Well, I took over as CEO in 1984. So I've had a pretty good run there. But I worked in the business most of the time since 1968. I started working there earlier in mid-60s, but just during the summers and in the warehouse pushing the broom around and all that. But I really began in earnest working with my dad, must have been about 71, something on that order.
I mean, the thing with Rickenbacker is that it has its own aura and it has its own sort of sense of sound. Like, I've had sort of crushes on Rickenbacker guitars in the way that I haven't, you know, like, I mean, Fender, there's a lot of different Fenders, a lot of different Gibsons. You know, the Telecaster's a great guitar, but there's something about the Rickenbacker that I'm like, oh my God, it's just the coolest thing. And the fact that they're, you know, they're all still made in the US, there aren't all sorts of copies of them everywhere. It just kind of adds to that mystique and also just that great chimey sound. So, you know, all this already, but I'm just saying, like, I'm just coming at this from, you know, a fan of like a lot of, I mean, the Beatles, you know, are where I start. And then REM was like my, you know, college band that I was like into when the first album came out and got to sort of see them grow from album to album. And I've done about, you know, many different, you know, REM related episodes here. And you taking over in 84, that's kind of like when the sort of second Rickenbacker surge would have been happening, I would have guessed, because Murmur was 83. And I mean, they got more popular later, but that's kind of 84 is like right in sort of when all those sort of jangle bands like, you know, REM and then, you know, Let's Active and all these other ones are kind of like making people aware of the Rickenbackers again. And the Jam was using them too. So, let's start in the middle. Like, what, when you took over, like, what was happening then?
Well, as you said, there seemed to be a resurgence. Obviously, the alternate grunge style was really beginning to catch its stride. And I suppose the timing was good for me personally, coming on board when all of that was happening. It was great to be able to interact with some of these people, even perhaps before they were that popular. But you know, that's part of been our whole thing. We support the people that have been our friends. You know, we're not out looking for endorsements of people we've never had anything to do with. So guys like Peter Buck and Darius Rucker and a lot of those types of people, it's been great to have a relationship from when they were just starting, essentially.
Right. So tell me about when you sort of discovered, I mean, obviously it was the family business, but you were like getting like autographed copies of Beatles albums in like 65 or something, right? I mean, like, tell me about just kind of growing up in the business.
Yeah. Well, I can't say that I immediately, when I was young, appreciated the business and the music world and all of that. And I'm not even sure that my dad looked at it as too much more than just a business. He'd been a businessman for a long time and been quite successful in some other areas. To him, I think this was sort of just another business. But as the Beatles came in and things really began to take off, I think he saw the magic in it. And same with me. I think I got really interested in music when I was 13, 1963. And I was away at a boarding school, kind of a British style boarding school. And all of the guys in the school were great record collectors and shall we say aficionados, if you can call the teenager an aficionado. It became very popular to hear music in the dormitories and all of that, and to share the latest band, the latest record. And I can certainly remember a lot of those coming along. I think the Doors were one of the ones I really remember as being popular. And I still probably didn't really appreciate it until slightly later, when I began to meet some of these musicians in person. And then I thought, yeah, you know, this is actually pretty cool. I had already been playing guitar. I had started playing guitar when I was 8. But I was playing classical guitar, not electric guitar. And I really didn't start playing electrics until 62, 63, I was playing surf music. I really liked surf music, and it took me a while to get into the Beatles and that style of music. But when it hit, it hit. And as you mentioned, getting that Beatles album and being able to meet the Beatles, all of that definitely lit a fire. And, here I am.
Give us the details on how you met the Beatles.
Well, I think everyone knows the story that my dad was there in '64 when they landed in New York and played at the played for Ed Sullivan. He was there. You can actually see the back of his head on the TV show.
Oh, wow.
He met them then, and there's a whole bunch of stories associated with that, but that's another matter. 65, my dad had a left-handed bass prepared for Paul, and we made the arrangement to go up and see the show at the Hollywood Bowl. And we did, and we were invited to meet back at the house that they were staying at. It was Zsa Zsa Gabor's home that they had rented there for a while they were in LA. And I got to hang out there, and I presented Paul with his first Rickenbacker bass. And at age 15, it was obviously a pretty heady experience. It was pretty amazing to see all of these people that I knew and had listened to on the radio just hanging around. I mean, it was a long list of people coming in and out of the place. But at age 15, I'm sitting in the living room, and I've got John, Paul, and George all plugged into one little tiny amplifier, playing away as Paul is testing his bass. I mean, here's me with a private Beatle concert.
Wow. Do you remember what they were playing?
I honestly don't. The thing that I do remember is that I could actually hear it, whereas down at the bowl, I couldn't hear a thing.
There you go. And Ringo, I'd heard that Ringo was off with some famous actress or something.
Yep.
You still won't say who it is?
Well, folk music field, but he was out there on the they were out there on the diving board outside, and anyway, they were having a great time.
They're just sitting on the diving board having a moment.
Something like that. I do remember him walking by through the living room. He was holding a glass of scotch that he was taking out there. But at age 15, I had never seen any of this kind of. I'd never been in this type of situation. And my dad, who's about the most straight-laced kind of guy you can imagine, he was just kind of expressionless, like, well, okay, that's what it is. And I can't imagine what he was thinking in his head, but it didn't faze him at all to see all of this going on. And years later, actually, this I met Roger McGuinn for the first time at that. As we met the Beatles, he was there.
He was at the house.
He was at the house along with the rest of the band, and I met him there. And he and I had a long conversation. I remember we were talking about guitar strings, and I had told him about a special 12-string set that I had made up for my guitar that I really liked. And he said, "Oh, cool. He'd like to try them." And I got an address, and I shipped him off a bunch of strings to try
Nice.
out. But from that point on, Roger became a pretty good friend, and over the years, we did quite a few things. Roger kindly, as I mentioned the other day, he played on a track on our little record. A lot of cool things. But years later, years and years later, he called me and he said, "John, you remember that night when we met?" "Yeah." "So, well, would you mind writing out everything that you remember from that night?" I said, "Well, yeah, I can do that, but why? You were there." He said, "Well, I'm writing a book, and yes, I was there, But there was some stuff going on, and so I don't necessarily remember everything. What are you talking about? I said, well, this house had a giant big shower in it. And we discovered that you could sit in the bottom of the shower and it had some amazing echo. And so we were all going back in there and singing. And oh, well, yeah, we were introduced to LSD. So it explained to me why there was such a flow of traffic going through this place. All the guys were going and taking guitars and things into the shower to try out the acoustics in this, and to, I suppose, to enjoy their trip. And it was the first time, he said, that the Beatles and the Birds had seen LSD before.
Wow. So you were there delivering the bass on that fateful day. I love though that, you're showing up at this, it sounds like this kind of Hollywood party house vibe, but you're bringing an instrument and they all sit around and they start playing them. Like they're not sort of like, okay, thanks, put it in the corner. Like they actually are engaged in it and the music was still first and foremost. Like they were excited to try out what you brought.
Paul was very, very excited. I remember John looking at it and said, oh, yeah, that's pretty nice. I like that. But it was Paul that was the one that was really excited about it. Nevertheless, I can't remember who suggested it, but one of them suggested, well, let's plug in and let's give it a try. And I mean, that was really an amazing moment. And I couldn't believe it. It was just an itty bitty little tiny Vox amp. And they had all three instruments jammed into it. I mean, it must not have had anything more than a 10-inch speaker. It was just incredibly cool to observe and hear.
John was playing, what was it, a 325? Is that the right
It's a
model?
325, yeah.
And then was John first and then George on the Ricks?
John started much earlier. He started playing in 58 with his he had a natural 58 325 that he purchased in Hamburg, and he played that throughout the Cavern Club days, as well as the clubs in Germany. And it was only years later, it was only on that trip in 64 that George was introduced. Well, it's not entirely true. George had, in fact, acquired a solid body Rickenbacker a couple of years earlier. His sister bought that in Illinois and shipped it off to him as a gift. But he didn't routinely play that guitar. And it was only after he had the 12 string in 64 that he began to use that in earnest during the years where you hear the 12 all over everything.
Right. And the 325 is a solid body also, right?
No, it's a hollow body, but it's a three-quarter size guitar. It's quite a small guitar.
Right.
Technically, it's a 5/8 scale. It seemed to suit John because my observation was that John seemed to have relatively short fingers, and it just seemed to work for him as a chording machine.
Right.
And I mean, no one forced him to use the guitar, so if he used it because he liked it and enjoyed playing it.
Now, were there models then that had three pickups and two pickups? Because when I see that, because it's a small guitar with these three pickups really close together, I sort of wonder about the thinking on that.
Well, that guitar was available as a two pickup. That would have been a Model 310, and it was available in that configuration. I'm not sure why the 320, the three pickup version, took off so much because I personally like the two pickup version myself. And as you note, it's pretty tight spacing there. It's pretty hard to avoid hitting that pickup with a pick. But it's also a guitar that's not for everybody just because of the overall size. Certainly, if you're a big strapping guy, that's not a guitar for you.
Right. Well, it's interesting because back then the Beatles were playing, they were playing Gretsches, they were playing Rickenbackers, but the Rickenbackers were the ones that kind of resonated. Like the Gretsches didn't have as distinct a sound and didn't take off in the same way. No offense to Gretsch, but it's just like the Rick was the thing. And it was Roger McGuinn, Jim back then, seeing them on Ed Sullivan and then getting his, getting his Rick and basically. The sound of folk rock was defined by, the birds doing Mr. Tambourine Man, and that really, the
Yeah.
jingle jangle, on that record.
Well, absolutely. Certainly that was the case. And Roger, Jim, as you say, was he paid dearly for that guitar. He traded in a number of instruments plus cash, but they had been out and seen the film in Hollywood and saw George and heard that sound, and almost immediately they said, we've got to have a guitar like that
A Hard
because
Day's
that's
Night,
the guy.
yeah.
And he went right out to was it Splevin's Music, and bought that guitar immediately. And like I said, he really had to pay dearly for that guitar.
So my neighborhood guitar store, Guitar Works, which is a wonderful place, I'm happy to give it a plug. They currently have a 1938 Rickenbacker B6 lap steel for sale. So it's 1938. A lot of those early Rickenbackers had were sort of the lap steel and also these sort of Hawaiian kind of guitars. Do you know sort of how it was that they got their characteristic sound on those electric guitars? That kind of chimey sound, which is certainly distinct from whatever they would have been doing at Fender.
Well, we're kind of talking two different animals there. The original wraparound horseshoe magnet type pickup that goes back to the steel guitar days was really perfect for that genre because that type of pickup actually captures string movement in all dimensions. When a string vibrates, it actually vibrates in a helix. And so that type of pickup is like a full surround type pickup. It's capturing the tone throughout that entire helix. Whereas the type of pickup that we use today with the pickup underneath the string is not picking up a full spectrum there. It's mainly picking up the horizontal motion of the string there. But it was great for a Hawaiian guitar because the artist could put his hand on the pickup. He had a natural hand rest. Plus, he could get a real solid hi-fi, high fidelity kind of sound out of a guitar that to that point you just hadn't been able to get. The Hawaiian guitar players were typically using some type of a resonator guitar or an acoustic guitar set in their lap. This allowed them to compete with the full band, the full orchestra, still have that hi-fi sound. Well, by the 50s, when my dad took over, he decided, and maybe this was his lack of understanding. He was not a musician. Maybe he didn't appreciate that perhaps some distortion, was actually kind of musical and something of value to a guitar player. And in fact, he went the opposite direction because he had been in the audio business for a number of years and it had always been trying to find high fidelity, real clearness, lack of distortion. And when he started working with the pickups early on, his whole goal was to achieve very, very clean, very, very clear, very, very hi-fi sound. And that's where all of the jangle and all of that stuff comes from.
That's interesting. So the idea was just to get like a really pure sound at that point. And was that the toaster pickups at the time?
Yes. The idea was no distortion, which is ironic because the other guitars in that era The humbucking pickups obviously introduced a lot of distortion in the sound, but we all like distortion too. They both have their place, but it was very, very different than the electric mainstream at that time.
Right. Yeah, and now you make ones with the toaster still, and I guess there are some humbucking Rickenbackers too. I'm not sure which model those are.
Well, the 200, 2000 series all had humbuckers. The 480, 41 had the humbucking pickup on it. There's been a number during the years, different varieties, different types worked quite differently. Some more similar to the classic style humbuckers, other types using different principle, but the basic concept of reverse polarity canceling out the different phase, that concept was still the same. There's been a wide variety of pickups over the years, and obviously the high gain pickups took over after the toasters, and the high gains certainly were capable of distorting very nicely and overdriving the input of the amplifier.
Right, so the high gains are standard on a lot of them now. It's I always had heard it basically, the Roger McGuinn was the toasters, the Peter Buck was the high gains,
That's
basically,
correct.
and the Paul Weller was the high gains as well. I mean, they all sound great, so.
Well, they all actually overlap. You can take one of the high gains and knock the volume control back a bit, and you can quite easily dial in the toaster sound. On the other hand, though, the toaster simply can't give you this distortion, the overdrive
Right.
that you get on the high gain. But both of them are capable of doing the toaster sound.
At what point did the 12 string, were the 12 strings introduced, and was there the surge of people buying 12 strings at the point when the birds came around?
Oh, absolutely. That was a very, very big time. 12s were just being produced in huge numbers. And it was an area that the company really distinguished itself. There really wasn't anyone else that had a comparable 12. A lot of people have made 12s, but they don't sound the same. They don't sound bad. They just sound different. And people, for whatever reason, really just wanted that Rick 12 string sound. And as a result, I can't tell you what the statistic is today, but at some point in the past, Rickenbacker had a 98% share of the market in 12 string
Oh,
electric
wow.
guitars. And I know we still totally dominate it. That there's no question. I don't know the exact number though.
What percentage of Rickenbacker guitars are 12 strings?
Believe it or not, a relatively small percent, probably no more than 20%. If someone characterized us as being a 12-string guitar company, they'd be very wrong.
Right. Yeah, well, 'cause more people just play sixes, but certainly there is that kind of the iconic Rick 12 string, so.
The 12-string market is one that we pretty well own. I'm sure we'll continue to own that one for a long time, just based on history. If you really wanted to classify us, we're very, very strong on basses. That's a big market for us. But still, the six-string guitar is the big seller for the company.
Right. No, again, I mean, when I saw REM the first time, which was, would have been 83. And then after that, you had Mike Mills on his Rick bass and, Peter Buck on his Jet Glow, was it 360 or 330? I think 360.
360.
Yeah. So, when you had these kind of surges in popularity, I mean, given that you're a family company and not this, multinational conglomerate with, manufacturing overseas and everything. How did you deal with the kind of the ups and downs of, the business?
Very, very difficult. because in a word, it was frustrating because here we had more business than we could handle, and we have customers that are ordering their guitar and they want their guitar. We have dealers that want to sell those customers their guitar, and we've got this huge backlog of dealer orders that we'd like to sell the dealers. And the thing is that I simply would never trade quality for quantity. And I always said, we're only going to make as much as we can absolutely ensure the quality. It would have been relatively easy to ship it overseas and increase the quantity. There are other things that probably could have been done that would have increased the quantity, but they would have affected the quality. We have had a huge backlog literally for decades, and it's strictly just based on what we can produce at the quality level we want to produce. There have been other constraints at some points in the past. The air quality regulations in California were such that we had an absolute limit in tons of VOC containing paints that we could use. And that was the limit. We could not spray 1 ounce more than that. Fortunately, over the years, we were able to work. We did work with the air quality people, and we came up with finishes that didn't have so much VOC in it that still met the quality standard. And over the years, we were able to work that such that that's not a constraint anymore. But there's only so many people out there that meet our criterion for quality craftsmanship. There's been other points in time. I can remember one era that I remember, like every young guy wanted to be the next dot-com zillionaire. They did not want to work in factories. They did not want any kind of a craft job at all. You know, they all wanted some type of computer-related profession. So the workforce was very, very hard to come by. And I know that there's been various permutations of that that have gone on through the years that have frustrated my son quite a bit, trying to get qualified people in there that are willing to work in a craft position.
Right.
It's gotten better. There are people, in fact, that like to be known as craftsmen capable of doing quality work. So that's a good thing. At the same time, though, we've also added a fair amount of automation where we can, but we won't automate anything that isn't at least an improvement upon what we've been doing. So if we can automate something so that we can get a better fit, a much more precise thing, we'll do it. But we don't want to automate anything that would degrade the quality of the product.
You know, when you see Rickenbackers being sold on, you know, eBay or Reverb or wherever, you know, they always n mentioned the year, you know, of the vintage, and you know, and there's a sense of, you know, the sort of the farther back you go, like a Bordeaux or something, you know, you're going to get the better ones because you're going back in time and you're remembering, you know, oh, this is when the Birds were playing or REM was playing or whatever. Is that like a nostalgia thing? Like, is a vintage Rickenbacker actually, does it have any more value in terms of being a playable instrument, or are you actually better off getting a new one?
Yeah, that's been a frustration of mine. I understand where that's coming from. It's kind of a collectability thing. Age is great, and I like old products as much as anyone. But in all honesty, the very best Rickenbackers being made are being made now, and they've only gotten better through the years. Much higher accuracy, repeatability from one model to the next. You know, there isn't all that variation. Now, some people would consider that, you know, really wonderful to have the totally handcrafted situation where each guitar is slightly different. Unfortunately, that doesn't work in the type of production level that we're trying to achieve. And in fact, making each one exactly the same as the last one is very important to us. And that was, for instance, the thrust when we first started using CNC on the wood shaping. We took the quintessential shape, the quintessential dimension of the instrument, replicated that in software, and now we have the machine building that original quintessential instrument over and over. There is nothing like hand craftsmanship, but there are plenty of great boutique shops out there that do just incredible work, but they're constrained by the number of instruments that they can put out, and it's actually quite hard for them to make a living just because of that. If you want to liken it to, say, the car business, there actually are plenty of Rolls-Royce and Bentley guitars being made out there, just not in any particular quantity. And we all know that there's tons of Toyotas and, God knows what low-cost instruments being made. We probably come in like a Porsche, mass-produced, but produced in a somewhat limited quantity, and at a very high level of quality and repeatability. That's probably about the best analogy I can give you.
Right. Yeah. And well, you have this sort of sweet spot where, again, you're not like mass producing it with factories all over the world. You're doing it in, is it one factory in California?
It's exactly one factory in California, and it always has been. Like I've said a number of times, we don't have to make a long distance call to talk to the factory.
Right. So, and obviously that's a conscious business decision. When you took over in 84, how much of a surge was there in interest in Rickenbackers?
Well, it increased quite a bit, and it came pretty fast, actually. It was a real challenge to stay on top of it. And as I said, it was an amazing frustration because we really wanted to obviously keep up with that surge. Everyone accused us of, playing a law of supply and demand, keeping the quantity low so that we could keep the price high. That kind of a game couldn't be further from the truth. We would love to have been able to meet everyone's order in a very, very short time period, and frankly, take the economic advantage of selling them a guitar. But it just wasn't possible to keep the quality that we felt was the hallmark of the company. We just had to keep that. So it has been an incredible effort to keep up with that demand. I don't know how reliable it is, but at one point there was an estimate that we probably only make enough product to service about one-eighth of the market that exists for the product.
Huh.
So we have a lot of room for growth, but again, with those within those parameters, that it's got to be good stuff.
Have you had, arguments within the company, within the family about, well, if we're only serving one-eighth of the people, we should expand. No, we need to keep it the way it is because this is how we keep it as, the quality where it is.
We haven't. We've all been on the same page on that one. The only time that we get that type of argument is from people outside the company. Why don't you go build this in China and make a cheap Rickenbacker in big quantity? That's just not what we're about. And I don't even think that's good business strategy myself. It's just not the way we do business.
And you've also been very on top of, you know, making sure the copies aren't, you know, coming out of Asia where it's, I mean, I saw some, you know, on eBay, just was called a Rick, but it was a Rickon or something like that. And, you know, obviously it was sort of a, you know, trying to rip off your design, but your the design and all of that stuff you have is copyrighted. So trademark,
well,
whatever.
It's an interesting thing. Yes, we have very definitely been strong on that issue. Part of the reason why is because we can. We are pretty much the only company that has across-the-board trademarks on all of our shapes in most of the world jurisdictions. We were very early on in registering these designs and these shapes. The other companies didn't do it. And most importantly, they didn't police it. So when suddenly there's a million Stratocaster copies, it makes it impossible, and no action is taken by the company. It made it impossible for them to hang on to their trademark. They tried, they did successfully receive a trademark on it, but I don't think it lasted even a year before it was struck down, because there was enough argument that it was public domain. Our instruments there's actually a certain point in time, I believe it's 10 years, where you file an additional document against the trademark that converts it from cement to stone. And we've been able to achieve that on all of our products across the way, so that it's you can't fight that trademark. It is rock at that point. And the other companies have not been able to achieve that on their core designs. But we have it on the body shapes, the head shapes. We actually have it on just the shape of the nameplate alone. Doesn't have to say Rickenbacker on it. It's just like the Nike swoop.
Interesting.
That little swoosh mark of ours is a registered trademark most of the world. So even just having that is an infringement. And I don't understand how people come back on us so hard for protecting our trademarks. Most of these guys are musicians, obviously. Most of them have written compositions. You know, they've written tunes,
right,
and written music. And some of them have published it and recorded it. How would they feel if we just took their song and recorded it and published it and made a bunch of money from it? It's such a simple concept. We came up with the design. We need to support the design. We have a couple hundred mouths to feed. That's what we're all about. And to take that design and do something else with it and sell it, that's theft.
You get a lot of blowback because you're protecting your trademark?
I seem to personally.
Huh.
People seem to think that I'm doing this personally, but you know, of course there's lawyers and all that mainly deal with that. And it isn't even so much all of these copies that are out there. They don't harm us economically. There's not enough market for them to really make any difference to our sales. The danger is the dilution of our trademark. You have one of these cheap guitars that has a Rickenbacker nameplate, and another unsuspecting person comes along and they see this lousy instrument and they say, oh, that's what a Rickenbacker looks like? Well, boy, that isn't very good. That's the damage. It's trademark dilution. And that's where it can come back and bite us in the long run.
Right. Well, there are other guitars that are out there, and when you're looking at them, you'll look at the sort of serial number maybe, or you'll look at where it's, and you're like, okay, this is one of the Korean ones, or one of the Chinese ones, or one of the ones they made in Mexico. And there's all sorts of kind of sleuthing you do to figure out where the guitars were manufactured, and then you can go on message boards and they're going to like have endless debates, you know, whether they're accurate or not about, you know, well, you know, the ones from this plant are better than this plant. Whereas with you guys, it's like, we know where they're built. We know when they're built. We know how it works, and there's a standard there, and it just takes all of that kind of guesswork and detective work out of it, because you know what it is. So, I mean, so as a consumer, I find that, you know, reassuring. So you know what you're getting when you get one of your guitars.
Well, at the same time, when you have one of our guitars, you know that over time, you know what happens with the value. It generally increases. Whereas if you have this off-brand copy, that isn't going to happen. And that is the benefit of having the genuine product, amongst other things. But like you said, you know, we're not opposed to a copy per se, even though there is a very strong ethical argument about someone, you know, ripping off someone else's design. But it's the fact of the long-range damage that can occur to any brand if that's allowed to continue.
Right. Do you guys reveal how many guitars you manufacture every year?
That's not published. It's a goodly number. It's a lot more than people would imagine. Like I said, my analogy with the Porsche, in the overall scheme of cars and things, that kind of fits in. You know, that's not the biggest maker in the world. There's a lot of much bigger makers.
Right.
But, you know, we do pretty well.
If you're looking at like a sales line from 84 when you took over the company to now, would it be like, would those numbers have gone up over time? Is it kind of a steady straight line?
Oh, no, it's gone up significantly.
And is that kind of a steady thing, or are there kind of like, you know, surges where like at certain points you're able to boost the manufacturing?
You know, it's pretty funny. That's one thing that our accountants shake their heads at. I can't tell you how many times they've told us that we've never seen a company that is so predictable. It is such a straight line thing. It is really not cyclical at all. It's all just straight lines.
Yeah.
And I can't say why that is exactly, but that is the way it's been. Sure, there have been a few things here and there where the world economy has shifted. But, you know, the way that we have tried to balance our international accounts versus our domestic North American accounts, we can kind of offset that. In the past, lots of times when there's been issues in Europe, the U.S. and North America has been doing well. So we just ship more into the North American market and vice versa. Right now, it's a little different because all the markets around the world are disrupted. And no one has the slightest idea of what's coming, where it'll go. So that remains to be seen. But we have always had that flexibility of being able to maneuver around that and keep that steady line increase.
And do you still have a backlog of orders? Like, you know, you have, there are more dealers who want them than guitars you have anyway. So it's kind of a capped thing at this point, right?
It's been that way for 20 plus years. There's this big, long backlog. And I know my son pulls his hair out when he sits down to do the scheduling for these, because it's like, you know, what do we make next? I mean, we try to do it on the oldest order is produced next. The problem is that as a manufacturer, we do have to group common instruments together for the economy of scale. You know, it isn't precise, but we try to do it that way. But what that means is that any given week, we're probably producing one family series. It might be 4,003 basses, but it'll be with a lot of different options and a lot of different colors and all of that. But we might do an entire week where we make nothing but basses. But the next week, it might be nothing but six string guitars.
Right.
But
And it might be like 330s 1 week and 360s 1 week or something like that.
Yeah, we wouldn't tend to mix those. We try to keep it within the same family. But, you know, there might be two pickup versions and three pickup versions and different colors and different bindings and things like that within a given week. So, you know, we do in that respect try to increase quantity through economy of scale and with a slight sacrifice to that exact order log, first order in, first order out.
Is the Fire Glow your most popular color?
Yeah. But the Jet Glow Black isn't far behind it.
Do you manufacture them in those proportions? Like you make more of the Fire Glows and then the Jet Glows and then the Maple Glows?
Well, if you're asking, do we kind of set the, we don't set that proportion. The customer's orders set that proportion. You know, if 60% of the customers order the Fire Glow, that's what we're going to make. So it is order driven. It's specific order driven. We don't produce ahead. We don't try to fill the warehouse with models and try to do some predictive thing where we say, okay, you know, we need to do 60% Fire Glow because that's probably what we're going to get orders for and put them in the warehouse. Doesn't work that way at all. Everything is sold. When it hits the end of the production line, it's shipped out usually the next day to a specific order.
So, and these are the retailers making the order. It's not like individuals are, you know, right, going on Rickenbacker's, you know, website and going, I want a Fire Glow 360 or something like that. I mean, this would be your guitar stores all over the country. So they're sort of predicting what's going to sell, even though they're all pretty much going to sell. Like Guitar Works has had Maple Glow ones the last couple of years when they get them, and they actually have a walnut one in right now. So I haven't seen like the jet glow or the Fire Glow there. I don't know whether they're ordering those because they just like those colors or whether that's sort of what's available.
Well, you're going to see both things happen. Some dealers are placing specific orders because the customer has come to them and said that's what they want. But for the most part, the dealers are ordering for their own inventory, and they're trying to do their best guess as to what they can sell. They're businessmen. They want to sell the most of whatever they can. And they'll try to second guess what their customers are likely to purchase. And then, of course, there's the whole distributor world. You know, probably about 40% of the goods go to distributors outside the U.S. And these guys have to really think well in advance. They have to think a year in advance and say, okay, you know, we ought to order 100 of these and, you know, 70 of these and try to predict the models and the colors and whatever that their dealers are going to buy and stock in the stores for their customers. So, you know, we're a couple of notches removed from that interaction.
And you guys have had different colors over the years. I mean, I've seen some, there's like a midnight blue, which I don't think you sell now. I've seen some teal ones. When you have these different colors, is it kind of like model years where you've sort of done that and then phased them out because of, you know, they didn't do as well, or you just decided you didn't need them? Like how does that work with the other colors that have kind of come in and out?
You know, in the past, it's almost just been fun to play around with some of these colors and see what people think. It actually probably really wouldn't have mattered that we came out with this special color. I don't think it would have affected sales one way or the other, but it has certainly created some interest. In recent years, I know Ben has really tried a much wider range of colors, and he's come up with some pretty interesting ones, some that I wouldn't touch, but others that are really quite cool. I know my wife absolutely fell in love with the British Racing Green, and the fact that she's British might have something to do with that. But you know, and our stove is British Racing Green, but that was a color that I certainly never made when I was actively involved in the business. So he certainly had some great ideas on colors, and he's been very creative in trying a few more models along with those different colors. I suppose trying to feel out the market and see where it might go. And he may well have some different take on what the company can sell. But for the most part, I tried to concentrate on bringing that backlog down, which pretty well meant standard colors.
Right. Well, and they're all, I mean, all of them look pretty cool to me. So, I can't see like not, I can't see sort of waiting for a guitar and being like, I just wanted a different color. But I mean, I'm sure people do that, but I'm not me. But in terms of the models of the guitars, I would guess the 330 or the 360 sells the most.
330. 330 has consistently been the top selling guitar, but the 360 for a number of years has definitely been right behind, and at points in time, the 360 has outsold the 330. But the 4003 bass, 330 guitar, 360 guitar, that's pretty well the way it lays out for the real quantity production.
And what do you think the reason is for the 330 over the 360? I mean, again, I've gone on like these, I've really geeked out on this stuff. It's part of why it's such a pleasure to talk to you about this, because I've just sort of been like doing this deep dive on these things because I'm just curious about it. And I know that the 360 kind of has the rounded edges. It has the stereo inputs instead of the mono. The 330 has the more pointy kind of design. It's a little more of, I guess, your classic Rick design. Maybe priced a little bit lower. I mean, like, what do you think the reason is for the distinctions between those two?
The 330 is like a VW Bug. It's utilitarian and does what it's supposed to do pretty well. The 360 is more like a 911, which it's more or less the same car as a Porsche, but with an awful lot of as the VW, but with an awful lot more enhancements and styling and features and all of that. But the 330 will do almost everything that the 360 will do. It's just really kind of an enhancement to move up to the 360. How many people actually use the Ricoh sound? I think it's a fairly small number, so I don't think that's really, maybe people think that they might use it, but in reality they probably don't. The binding, yeah, it protects the guitar a little bit more from wear over the years. The shape of the body, that's a pretty good enhancement, actually. It really does lessen the friction on the back of your arm crossing the guitar there. So it's a little more comfortable. But for the most part, the 330 at a much lower price point does almost everything the 360 does.
Right. And then there's the 620, which is a solid body, which now when I look back on the cover of Tom Petty's Damn the Torpedoes, it looks
Yeah.
like that's what he's holding, right? Is that a 620 there?
It certainly is, yeah.
What do we think of that one? Like, how much of a difference is it that it's a solid body instead of hollow body in terms of the sound or any of this stuff?
To my ears, it's a very, very cool difference. I really like the really solid sound that a hollow body guitar gives you. I mean, they both have their place, but for a really insistent, a very in-your-face kind of sound, you really can't beat a 620. That was just an amazing, amazing guitar. And personally, I think we should be building a lot more of those. And I think people are appreciating that. They're buying the 660, of course, which is the upgraded 620, was in the Tom Petty limited edition. A little bit wider fingerboard, a little bit wider neck. Personally, I prefer the feel of the 620, but to each his own. So, I mean, I think that the 600 solid body series is just an amazing series.
My local record store, the guitar store, has a sale every year, and they had a 620 this year. And I've always as I've said, I've had like a guitar crush on Rick's for forever, and I play guitar not that well, but I like to play it. It's one of the things in these dark times that brings me some joy, and I was like, you know what, I'm just going to do it. And a year earlier, they had a 330, and I kind of had non-buyer's remorse at not having jumped at it before someone else got it. So I got the 620. It's maple glow. It's beautiful. Plays really well. There's part of me that's still like, I need to at some point have like the iconic hollow body, maybe the 12 string, you know, Rick, just to have that. But I've totally enjoyed playing the 620, and it feels really easy to play. It's, the sound is great. So anyway, that's my personal Rick, situation.
Well, I've always enjoyed the 600 series guitar, and, my wife has, she has 330s, she has 360s, she has a couple of 381s, and I know with no question whatsoever that her 620s are the favorite instruments.
Nice. Do you guys have like any like marketing and advertising departments, or do you just really not need them?
It's a totally unnecessary function. There is no sales function whatsoever. We have no outreach. No one's calling on dealers. We depend on the dealers to come to us and say, oh, you know, we're in so-and-so. And, you know, we look and see if we have any dealer conflicts. And if we don't, and they pass our qualifications, you know, we're happy to have them. But then they need to call us if they want something. We don't call them and say, hey, you need to order more. We don't do that. We don't even have anybody to do that. We only have a customer service department, and they take the orders as well as handle all of the different customer service issues. There is no sales function whatsoever in the company.
Nice.
Hasn't been as long as I can remember.
So when, you know, again, when someone's buying a guitar, they're not paying for your marketing. They're just paying for what went into making the guitar.
There is no line on the profit and loss that says advertising or promotion.
Are there any misconceptions about Rick's that you would want to clear up? I mean, sometimes I'll see people saying, well, you know, a Rick is a great guitar for a rhythm player, but, you know, if you want to shred, you know, you need to get a Les Paul or something like that.
There's too many demos on YouTube anymore that show that just isn't an accurate statement.
Right. Anything, like, if you're sort of looking out over the next, I don't know, 5 years, is there anything that you think is going to change in some way? Are you guys manufacturing in the U.S., but are these tariffs going to affect you in terms of any materials or any of that?
Well, it remains to be seen on some of it, mainly because none of us know what really is going to happen. But I think we're in pretty good shape compared to a lot of companies, simply because there is almost no import content in the product. The only thing that's imported are the key winds and a couple of other components. There's some small electronic components that, frankly, we just don't make in the U.S. You basically cannot buy a capacitor or a potentiometer in the U.S. They just don't exist. And if someone came out with a U.S. made product, we'd buy it. You know, the actual parts cost for non-U.S. components is very, very small. So even if there was a hefty tariff, it really wouldn't make much difference to us. Where it could make a difference is in our ability to export. If there are reciprocal tariffs in other countries against our U.S. tariffs, then it's going to make it harder for us to sell guitars overseas.
Right.
Right now, we haven't seen any of that. This last year has been a really, really strong year in export for us. In fact, this is one of the strongest export years in many years. Even though there has been the start of some tariff war things going on, but we just have to see what how that goes. There's just no way to predict.
What's the split between U.S. sales and overseas sales for you?
It's about 60 overseas and 40 US at the moment. In previous years, it was more like 40 overseas and 60 in the US. But that hasn't been a function of anything that we've done. I mean, not in the sense that that's the markets haven't dictated that. We've made that decision. We've looked at the markets and decided, okay, we need to ship more here domestically in order to service the domestic market to help flesh out certain territories in the US, that kind of thing. But at the same time, we've also tried to keep some of our overseas suppliers in goods so that we can keep our name up and keep the market going in a particular country. And we've been faced with some other issues. I'm sure you've seen on many products you buy this CE mark. It's a symbol, it says CE, and it's not precisely the same thing as UL approval, but it's the European certification, and it covers more than electrical stuff. I mean, it covers lead in the electronics. It covers the other chemicals in plastics and all of this. And we have had to go through some really, really extensive testing in order to stay in the EU market in order to meet the CE standards. And I'll be blunt, I don't think most of our manufacturers' products, even though they have the CE mark on them, I don't believe they've actually been tested to the standard. We've had to send a number of instruments in for destructive testing. They literally take every part apart and test every little part for any type of traces of lead or phthalate plastics or whatever. We've had to meet that standard, and we do. We have the lab reports to prove it. And that it's that knocked us back for probably 2 years in Europe in order to get that full certification. And I just haven't seen any evidence that a lot of the other companies actually have done that. The other side of the coin is that the European authorities haven't always fully enforced their own regulation. They've allowed stuff in, even though it's marked CE, but it really isn't CE compliant. They haven't really made an issue out of it. They are, and they will, and we're ready.
So what is the biggest, your biggest market outside the US?
UK, followed by Germany. Germany, in fact, actually doing distribution in a wider range of countries. And then beyond that, France, which also does a wider range of distribution, such as the Benelux countries and so forth.
Yeah, you've always had that UK connection, though.
UK connection is very strong. Japan is a market that's gone up and down, up and down. Right now it's on the rise. It's going up fairly rapidly. Should there be some reciprocal tariffs in the future, that could change.
All right. And my last thing is, what music are you making these days?
Not enough of it, unfortunately. I'm a little bit limited. I don't really have a great studio space here in the UK yet. This is more of a farm, and I really don't have the right kind of place yet. My main studio is out in California, so it kind of limits me to about 4 months out of the year doing music. But I have laid in a lot of music gear here, and trying to even in my little office here to trying to set out a corner to do some music. And to answer your question more simply, I'm actually looking more towards some keyboard-oriented stuff along with guitars.
Right. Well, and you've got all that unreleased Hotwork stuff, right?
We still have all of that, and that's been something that's been a real long project. Ironically, a large percentage of the band members are British, but they live in California.
Oh, see, there you go. You guys flip-flopped.
So we're kind of on opposite cycles here, and it's made it really difficult to get together and do stuff. But the stuff is just too good not to get out there at some point.
Yeah, no, well produced, well played, good songs. What's your go-to instrument, by the way?
Well, I'm a bass player primarily, and I have a 4004 bass, which is pretty special, gold hardware, but it's also got a really nice maple and walnut sandwich body, and I just love that instrument. That's my go-to instrument.
Nice. Well, thank you so much for talking to me and letting me nerd out on all this Rick stuff. It was really great, and I really appreciate it. And I've appreciated the music that you guys have, helped get into the world. So it's a lot of the best stuff that's ever been recorded. So thanks.
Yeah, well, thank you very much. I appreciate hearing all of that. It's been my pleasure.
That's all for episode 185 of Caro Pop. Thanks so much to John Hall for taking us deep into the very cool world of Rickenbacker guitars and basses. The company's website, rickenbacker.com, offers lots of great information about Rickenbacker's history and guitar models, including details on the materials used and manufacturing processes. It also offers information about dealers that sell Ricks. You can follow Rickenbacker Official on Instagram. Caro Pop is produced by Chris Swake, who gets to work early every jingle jangle morning. Thanks to all who support Caro Pop. If you'd like to throw something into the Caro Pop kitty, we'd be much appreciative. You can give $24 or whatever you'd like at caropop.com. Thanks so much for listening and being here. I'm Mark Caro. Please follow Caro Pop on the so-called socials at Caro Popcast. You can follow me as well at Mark Caro at MarkCaro. Please share this episode, subscribe, tell your friends, and tune in again next week for another Caro Pop conversation. Thanks.